Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast here at peterbcollins.com. I consider this to be a very important story. Broken by independent journalist Whitney Webb at mintpressnews.com for American audiences. And it involves a sinister extortion scheme that I consider to be much more sinister than the Ukraine scenario that Trump is being impeached for. It's the story of his threats against the government of Iraq and its prime minister, including death threats, that have not been reported in the corporate media here in the United States. Stick around, you'll learn more. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who subscribe and ship in $10, $20, sometimes even $40 a month. People like John Zwiebel, Paul Elsesser, and Jerry Frazier. You can join their ranks. All you have to do is visit peterbcollins.com, click on menu, click on become a subscriber. You'll hit the sign-up page, and you can take it from there. Thanks for listening, and do share this podcast with other like-minded individuals. To start off the new year of 2020, Donald Trump launched a drone strike in Baghdad that killed one of Iran's top generals, proving that he's an assassin. Art rock band Marillion opens the podcast today as we welcome back investigative journalist Whitney Webb, who is a senior reporter at Mint Press News, and she published a story in mid-January that I think deserves a great deal of attention. Whitney, thanks for rejoining us here today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be back.
And I just want to note the incredible work that you've done. Pulitzer doesn't really seem to pay attention to independent media, but your in-depth reporting on Jeffrey Epstein, I think, set a real standard for media in general and shamed the corporate media. And I just want to acknowledge that and thank you for it.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Yeah, it was a lot of work went into that, and I'll actually be putting out a book and doing a new series on Epstein coming up in a couple months.
Oh,
so anyone interested in that can, you know, look forward to that.
Well, the work that you've done to date was book length, so I'm glad you are going to compile it and perhaps reach a wider audience. Whitney, I asked you to join me today because you're one of the first American-based media outlets to publish a story related to the full comments that were made on January 5th in Baghdad by the Prime Minister Abdul Mahdi. And I consider this very important because as we speak, the impeachment trial of Donald Trump is underway in the Senate based on the charges that he intimidated or leveraged U.S. aid against the new prime minister of Ukraine in a kind of thuggish approach to diplomacy that has been exposed. And it's quite a little scheme that involves many of his top players in the administration and Rudy Giuliani and his cohorts as well. But what you have reported here, based on the comments of the Iraqi prime minister, suggests a much more sinister scheme of this kind of thuggish diplomacy aimed at extracting oil revenues from Iraq and even including direct threats on the life of the prime minister. And I think this is a very important story that has largely been blacked out by the corporate media here.
Yeah, well, you're definitely right about it having been blacked out. The only store English language website that I saw, at least at the time I wrote my report, that had covered this was Southfront, which doesn't usually get a lot of traction in the media landscape, though. That's, you know, they do good work. But that's definitely true that it has been almost entirely ignored, considering the gravity of the claims that Iraq's prime minister has made, and especially considering, you know, what was alleged to have gone on with Trump and all of this attempt to interfere with Ukraine and all of that, the type of thuggish behavior, what I call gangster diplomacy, you know, doesn't even compare, I think, to what the claims of Iraq's prime minister were in this situation. And basically, to give a quick overview, a lot of this has to do, according to Iraq's prime minister Abdul Mahdi, has to do with efforts at the U.S. to try and, or by the Trump administration, to get Iraq to agree to a very unfavorable deal or an exchange of oil revenue for reconstruction projects that would be completed by the U.S. But what ended up happening is that because that was considered unfavorable by the prime minister, well, the offer that Trump had made, which was that the U.S. wanted 50% of all of Iraq's oil revenue in exchange for completing reconstruction projects to which the U.S. had already committed, to do what had been dragging their feet on doing. There was a counter offer that was made by China that was to do the same reconstruction projects, but in exchange for about 20% of Iraq's oil revenue. So what happened is that at the end of September, Iraq sent a delegation to China, and they hammered out this oil for reconstruction deal that was, you know, obviously much more favorable than the U.S. offer. And after that was cemented, Abdul Mahdi has claimed that the Trump administration, and Trump specifically and directly, you know, threatened Al Mahdi in various ways. First, threatening that he would stoke protests that would see him removed in power from power. Sorry. And that actually coincided with the timing of these embassy protests in Iraq and protests that were actually throughout the country and deserve a lot of scrutiny as well, because what ended up happening is that Iraq's prime minister and also the defense minister of Iraq claimed that there were started openly discussing in Iraqi media reports of there being a quote unquote third side at these protests that was firing, you know, live ammunition at both security forces and at protesters alike. And as they began to talk about that, Abdul Mahdi claimed that he was threatened by Trump to stop mentioning this third side. And if he did not, that he and the defense minister would be killed by the U.S., presumably.
And this occurred during the month of October. And as you point out the timeline in your article, Abdul Mahdi and a delegation had returned from Beijing during the final week of September. And while there could be many causes for the protests that erupted, there is a nexus here between threats from Trump and the street protests that claimed dozens of lives in Baghdad and other cities across Iraq, mostly during the month of October.
Right. That's correct. And this apparently, as I said earlier, you know, culminated in December with these threats in November with these threats to have the prime minister and the defense minister killed. And Abdul Mahdi claimed in Iraqi parliament that his reason for resigning from his post as prime minister was because of those threats, which is really significant. But, you know, Abdul Mahdi is still the prime minister of Iraq. It's important to point that out. He is serving in a caretaker role until parliament chooses his replacement, right? So he's still there, and he's still making a lot of the decisions that we're seeing now going forward. And you can definitely tell that he is pretty much now, after recent events, very determined to maintain Iraq's independence and move forward with these deals with China, despite the pressure that Trump has tried to apply, showing that this has really been counterproductive for the U.S. administration and is really driving Iraq into the arms of its rivals, not just in terms of, you know, the oil industry in Iraq, but also in terms of military cooperation, military arms purchases and other things.
So, Whitney, as I kind of reconstruct these events, we know that there were protests during the end of December that drifted into the early days of January at the Green Zone Embassy of the U.S. in Baghdad. And Trump has exaggerated the nature of those protests. There was a reception room that was set on fire. But by and large, the facility remained intact and the protesters dissipated. So then we launched the assault violating the sovereignty of Iraq without notice to our own allies, our own leadership. The Trump administration unilaterally took the opportunity to execute General Soleimani after he flew into Baghdad late at night. And we learned from the first reporting that the parliament meeting that was held on January 5th, the corporate media reported that that was only about a call for the U.S. to pull its troops out of Iraq. And the notation was that this was a non-binding resolution, that there wasn't unanimity in the Iraqi parliament. And then Max Blumenthal expanded on those reports by getting a translation of notes that were taken by parliament members after the video feed had been mysteriously cut from this session of parliament. And what Blumenthal added to it was a very important piece that General Soleimani was in Iraq to try to continue a conversation that was being brokered by Prime Minister Abdul-Mahdi between Iran and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. So that put Soleimani on a peace mission. There are suggestions that Trump actually induced or lured him into this role and knew that he would be in Baghdad at that time. We have reports that Israeli intelligence helped keep a definitive track on Soleimani's location. And then an item that was published on January 8th in a kind of murky media outlet called Strategic Culture Foundation, under the byline of an Italian reporter, Federico Piracini, basically took a translation and moved the reporting further to indicate the threats that you have reported directly from President Trump to the life of Abdul-Mahdi. And this report I shared with my listeners with the caveat that it was a murky source and a single report, but because it was consistent with Max Blumenthal's reporting, I felt it deserved their attention. So you have taken this even further, and may I ask first, where did you get your English language translation of the notations that were taken in the Iraqi parliament?
So at Mint Press, we have several people that are fluent in Arabic, and they translated, I don't speak Arabic, so they translated the Arabic for me. It came from an Arabic news website called, in English, the name of the page is Illuminations, and that claimed to have taken the notes that Blumenthal also cited as having received from that parliamentary session after the video feed was cut, that it was basically a transcript of what Abdul-Mahdi had said that had been taken down in note form by deputies and other members of parliament that were present after that video feed was cut. It's also worth pointing out, too, that the video feed was cut by Muhammad al-Habusi, who is a prominent Sunni MP in Iraq's parliament and also has a very close relationship with Washington and the U.S. State Department, including Mike Pompeo and other figures like that. And his attendance at this session, that this parliamentary session, is interesting, because that session was boycotted by factions in Iraqi politics that are often aligned with the U.S., including certain blocks of Sunni politicians and also the Kurdish faction did not attend. But al-Habusi did, and he is the person who's alleged to have cut that video feed because he knew of the remarks that Abdul-Mahdi planned to say after this vote on the voting on the expulsion of troops went forward. So there was obviously something there that, you know, this individual, in considering his ties to Washington here, is important, that this individual did not want to be included in the video feed. Right. So I think that's really significant. I mean, obviously, a big part of this, too, about the diplomatic role of Soleimani, I want to touch on really quick, too, because it's also been since alleged, by people like Michael Hudson writing in Counterpunch and some other sources, that one of the diplomatic functions that Soleimani was serving in his relation with Iraq's current government was also related to Iraq's push for oil independence and implementing some of these new oil deals with China. And Hudson in that article I'm mentioning in Counterpunch alleges that some of that had to do with the timing of the assassination as well, since we know, you know, in, from recent reporting that it's been several months. That this was an operation that was approved several months ago. And the timing seemed sort of impulsive. And there were all these claims of an imminent threat, which later gave way to it doesn't matter if there was an imminent threat or not and things like that. So, you know, given what we've discussed so far, it's interesting to consider, you know, that aspect as well in terms of the Soleimani killing and what's transpired since and the fact that it took place in Iraq and not in another location.
And this idea that Trump has had, he surfaced it in the campaign back in 2016, that we should take the oil of Iraq, not even negotiate, just
right.
we should take it. We are entitled to it. And, you know, his repeated efforts to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria only to be countermanded, and I can't explain. You know, I'm not a Trump supporter, but I support his aspirations to bring our troops out of Islamic countries. And I think that, you know, he tried once and was blocked when Bolton was there. Then post-Bolton, he tried again. And, you know, now we're keeping a couple of hundred troops in northeastern Syria to protect the oil for our confiscation down the road, presumably. And this is a very bizarre form of international relations that relies on bullying. And at a certain point, I don't think, particularly in Syria, that with a minimal number of troops, that we can maintain this obsession or even delusion that we are entitled to their oil.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that Trump has not only been not only was he open about this during the election season, but even in his dealings with Iraq's prime minister prior to all of these things that have been going on more recently, you know, beginning with September and all of that, actually in a meeting last March that he had with Abdul Mahdi, he openly talked about taking the oil to his face. And it was reported on in the media as sort of being a, you know, hide your face in your hands moment for people, other, you know, national security officials that were present at that meeting, because it was just so blunt the way that Trump had sort of broached this with Iraq's prime minister and was basically trying to say, so what about the oil? We want the oil, things of that nature. And that was just a year ago, preceding a lot of these other tensions that, you know, also have a relation to Syria in some extent. So remember, before September, there was also, I think, a month or two prior to that, Iraq was also, or Abdul Mahdi was opening opening a border crossing,
right,
between Iraq and Syria, a new one that was considered, you know, unfavorable for U.S. And also Israeli military objectives in that area, which sort of, you know, some people have argued sort of set off these tensions that have since spiked, where Iraq is sort of going against Washington's desires. And, you know, starting off small, I guess, and progressively getting more intense. And obviously, you know, after the Soleimani killing, that has just gotten much more extensive. So, for example, this whole oil deal that Trump allegedly threatened Abdul Mahdi over, after the Soleimani killing, Iraq tripled the amount of oil it was going to give in export to China, which, you know, appears to kind of be a, you know, a rebuke of all of that, of what Trump had threatened. And this came a day after it was allegedly another threat that was allegedly, you know, given to Iraq's prime minister by Trump, which was that the U.S. was going to cut off Iraq's central bank account, which is held at the New York Federal Reserve, where a lot of its oil revenue is stored, if they actually did go forward with expelling U.S. troops. Which is also, you know, that threat, which was actually directly reported by the Wall Street Journal and all of this, is really consistent with Abdul Mahdi's past claims of the type of private threats that are given by the Trump administration to Iraqi leadership, but not necessarily made in public forums.
And Whitney, let's pause for a moment just to consider the bigger picture here, that Saddam Hussein was Sunni, and presided over a Shia majority population in Iraq. And by toppling him in the 2003 invasion and the ensuing occupation, we tried to reconstruct the government of Iraq with more participation from Shia. that inevitably drew influence from Iran. Muqtada al-Sadr and others have long had, and the Ayatollah Sistani, have had strong relations with Iran. And during the battle over the Islamic State, the U.S. Tolerated Iran's participation in pressuring the so-called ISIS fighters out of Anbar province. And there are many cases where the U.S. provided air cover for Iranian-backed militias that were central to pressuring the Islamic State out of the Anbar province and that region in Iraq. And we know that General Soleimani was central to those efforts. So he was, in that case, at least not an enemy of the United States. And so to what extent is the Sunni-Shia tension and the interests of Iran playing out in Trump's efforts here? Or is he primarily obsessed just with getting the oil and, trying to settle scores and balance the books in his head from our long-running occupation there?
Well, I think the oil is the whole China oil aspect. I don't really want to argue that it's the main factor driving all of this, but I think it's a very overlooked factor. And I think the media blackout over it and of Abdulmahdi's claims is really significant and suggests that it's more influential than, the media and, has been willing to acknowledge up to this point. But I do think, too, that definitely the U.S. and the Trump administration has, a regional concern with what they call Iranian influence. But, this axis of resistance, basically any political party that gains influence that is adamantly opposed to Washington's designs on the region, which a lot of those have are, Shia majority countries that have some, influence from Iran to some extent. But as to what's really driving Trump in his policy in Iraq right now, I think a lot of it has to do with oil. And I think a lot of it has to do with trying to not lose the U.S.'s foothold in the Middle East and maintain sort of regional dominance, being sort of like the hegemon, not just in the Middle East, but in the world. If, Iraq, post-invasion Iraq, is able to disentangle itself, not just from its economic ties to the U.S. and through the oil industry and all of that, but also militarily with, the expulsion of U.S. troops, that could really signal the waning of U.S. influence, as a regional power broker in the Middle East and also potentially on a global scale, sort of keep, Iraq relatively weak and open to U.S. influence by having, these political divisions between Iran. This whole, this angle of how much of a factor that is, I think the media silence on that suggests that it's much more influential than it's, being, than has been suggested. And I think a lot of that, too, when you look at U.S. geopolitics, a lot of it has to do with oil, and a big part of that in at some level has to do with the petrodollar, which, is the basis for the U.S. being a reserve currency and what allows the U.S. to go into massive amounts of debt to fund its global military empire, Wall Street bailouts here in the U.S., and things of that nature because of the demand for dollars the petrodollar system creates. And China has openly said that it wants to create a petro yuan system that would directly compete with that. So anytime China is going to bite in, I guess you could say, to what the oil sales that were originally for the petrodollar is going to be viewed as a threat by the U.S. And also the fact that the more threatened the Trump administration feels by this, what they view as encroachment by China and into a power broker. I think they're concerned about that waning influence there. And the more threatened they feel that way, the more the Trump administration has been using these pressure tactics that ultimately backfire and push these countries more into the arms of these rival states. And these rival states also include Iran. And a lot of these countries in the Middle East and political parties in the Middle East that are, by and large opposed to Washington's designs on the region, oftentimes are Shia or aligned with Shia groups who, some people call them the axis of resistance and things of that nature. So I think that's definitely a dynamic as well, too, in terms of what the regional balance of power will be. And obviously the U.S. and also its regional allies like Israel obviously opposes any type of influence that Iran would have in that capacity.
Well, and Whitney, in past administrations, we separated military policy from trade policy, but Trump, generally lumps them all together. And so we can't ignore the trade war that he started with China and the kind of, face-saving agreement, this phase one agreement that he announced just as the impeachment trial was starting up. And I don't think there is very much in that agreement. Past history shows us that China is really good at signing agreements and not so good at keeping them. But the struggle over the petrodollar, I think, looms behind both the trade war and the military tensions.
Right. I think that's definitely true. And what's interesting about this phase one trade deal is that, like you said, it didn't really have much there. But one thing it did include was basically China promising to buy, I think, several billion dollars worth of U.S. oil and gas, which is pretty significant because obviously that would be oil and gas commodities produced in the U.S. and then sold in dollars, again, sort of a hedge against, oil sales and gas sales being denominated in another currency besides the dollar, or being like the steel in Iraq, which is sort of exchanging services.
Well, and Whitney, consistency is not something we can attribute to Trump. He's all over the place in boasting that we don't need anybody else's oil, and so we can attack Iran and not worry about the Strait of Hormuz and, shutdown of the transit of oil supplies. They've been trying to set up LNG, liquid natural gas exports. And this is all based on fracking and destruction of the planet. He seems completely oblivious to the connectivity of those factors. But when we try to boil down his statements, he both claims that we don't need anybody else's oil, but that we are entitled to take oil from Iraq and from Syria. And it is bizarre, and it's also notable that there are very few voices either in the United States or in other countries or, say, the European Union who are really speaking out against these very dangerous power grabs by the United States.
Yeah, I think this is just another example of how Trump's approach to foreign policy has really alienated a lot of people that were or a lot of countries that were allies previously and are now sort of rethinking whether or not the U.S. is reliable in matters of diplomacy, which is really allowing has really played into the hands of Russia, for example, which is sort of emerging as this new, more reliable power broker in the Middle East. A lot of people have made that claim since then because and Russia has openly pretty much said that the U.S. isn't, capable of keeping agreements that it makes. And, Trump has really, through his foreign policy in the past few years, has really shown that to be the case, which is, unfortunate from the perspective of those that want to maintain, the U.S. role as like the number one world superpower and its global influence and things like that. But it's just another example of how this is just becoming more, I guess you could say, with the Trump administration, these types of dealings always sort of went on in U.S. political history. But here, it's like the mask is off, like they're not really as worried about maintaining a veneer of diplomacy and humanitarianism. It's really what have always sort of been the underlying factors of these types of moves is just really out in the open here, and they're not even trying to hide it anymore. That's what it looks like to me.
Well, and as I commented at the outset, and as we wrap up here, Whitney, this is a very serious set of allegations coming from Prime Minister Abdul-Mahdi. And I led my podcast when I reported on your story with impeachable. To me, this is a much more serious crime than the entire narrative about Ukraine, which I do acknowledge I was skeptical at first, but I think that there is a significant body of evidence that has been developed, and there is clear obstruction of evidence and witnesses by Trump that is highly suggestive of guilt on his part. But if he's dealing with most foreign nations that aren't in the first tier, in this kind of extortion diplomacy model. There are a lot of more instances of this that are likely to surface.
Yeah, I definitely think that's true. But I think the reason the focus has been Ukraine is because it involved directly Joe Biden.
Sure.
And that has sort of put the DNC and the Democrats on a much higher alert than, say, what has been alleged by Iraq's prime minister. Because, you know, with the DNC or with the Democrats, this plays into sort of the whole 2020 election narrative that the establishment Democrats have been promoting. So I think, you know, keeping the focus on that during impeachment sort of plays into, you know, establishment Democrats' political goals. Whereas if they were to address, you know, Abdul-Mahdi's claims directly, I think that would threaten forces that back both establishment Republicans, the Trump administration, and also establishment Democrats.
Very well said. Whitney Webb, thank you for joining us today. Thanks for the excellent work you do. And I hope this story gets a very broad distribution. Trying to do my part to assist in that.
Thank you. Me too.
Thanks for listening to this important in-depth interview with journalist Whitney Webb. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.